Digital 410 Productions proudly presents What's the Scuttlebutt Podcast with your host, Don Everett.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, last night when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment the troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day, without rest, until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. For these men are lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in thee in this hour of great sacrifice. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events, of temporal matters of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen.
As the early hours of June 6, 1944, set in motion the largest invasion of world history, much of the world had already been affected by the war since its beginning on September 1st, 5 years earlier. The United States Marine Corps and U.S. Navy had been at war with Japan since August 7th of 1942, the 25th Infantry Division of the United States Army joined the fray on Guadalcanal on November 25th. The United States began to direct military assistance in North Africa on May 11, 1942, and completed the campaign by May 13, 1943, with a total usage of 107,000 ground forces, 210 tanks, and 500 aircraft. The invasion of Sicily, codenamed Operation Husky, began before dawn on July 10, 1943, involving 150,000 troops, 3,000 ships, and 4,000 aircraft, all directed at the southern shores of the island. Not to overlook other important campaigns such as Anzio, Po Valley, Tunisia, and plenty of others, these are a mere sample in the timeline of campaigns to provide a glimpse of effort, hardships, and loss faced by the Allied nations all around the world leading up to the invasion of Normandy on June 6, 1944. Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Commander of Allied Expeditionary Forces, gives the go-ahead for a massive invasion of Europe called Operation Overlord, with the original launch date of June 5, 1944. But due to bad weather, the launch date had to be postponed. Wrestling with undesirable weather reports, there was a growing concern of the possibility of long-term postponement for the launch of the campaign. However, due to a break in weather, the mission was a go and set to launch on June 6th.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
13,100 American paratroopers of the 82nd and 101st Airborne Division assigned objectives on the peninsula west of Utah made a night parachute drops on the early mornings of D-Day, June 6th, followed by 3,937 glider troops flown in by day.
This is Charles Collingwood. We are on the beach today on D-Day. We've just come in. We caught a ride in a small boat which came in from our LST loaded with 1,000 pounds of TNT. While we have been here, we have just seen one of the strangest and most remarkable sights of this invasion so far. Two great fleets of over 100 gliders have gone overhead, towed by C-47 transports, who are certainly proving the workhorses of this invasion. They've hauled them right over the beaches, and it seems as though the German gunners, amazed at this incredible sight, have stopped firing on the beach now because it's quiet here, and the second batch are droning over now. I can see them. They're casting off the gliders as they circle around over the beach, and the transports are circling around and beginning to make off home. Where they're landing, we don't know because we're down here on the beach, and there's a seawall in front of us, and we can't see the land behind.
The British 6th Airborne Division was assigned to capture intact the bridges over the Caen Canal and the River Orne. The Free French 4th SAS Battalion of 538 men was assigned objectives in Brittany. Prior to the invasion, 300 men of the Pathfinder's companies were organized into teams of 14 to 18 paratroopers whose main responsibility would be to deploy ground beacons from the Rebecca Eureka transponding radar systems and to set out Holophane marking lights. The amphibious landings at Utah Beach were undertaken by the troops of the United States Army, made up of the 4th Infantry Division, the 90th Infantry Division, and the 4th Cavalry Regiment, with sea transport, minesweeping, and naval bombardment forces provided by the United States Navy and Coast Guard, as well as elements from the British, Dutch, and other Allied navies. Though the landings at Utah Beach would be considered a success, the casualty and losses for the Allies totaled 197 for the 4th Infantry Division, 2,499 airborne troops, and 700 casualties in other units. The original plans for Pointe du Hoc had called for a larger Ranger force, consisting of Companies A and B of the 2nd Ranger Battalion and the entire 5th Ranger Battalion to follow as the second wave. Flares from the clifftops were to signal the second wave to join the attack, but due to the delayed landings, the signal came too late and the other Rangers landed on Omaha Beach instead of Pointe du Hoc. Some speculate that the 500 plus Rangers provided on the stalled Omaha Beach landings helped to prevent disastrous failures there, since they carried the assault beyond the beach into the overlooking bluffs and outflanked the German defenses.
This is the way the beach looks, which was hit by our troops about 12 hours ago, early this morning. It's a flat, sandy beach, like almost any beach that you're likely to see, and it slopes gently away from the seashore up to the dunes and then to the sea wall, which was the first objective of our troops and which they took early on in the game.
The Rangers had learned at the top of the cliffs that their radios were ineffective upon reaching the fortifications, and also discovered for the first time the main objective of the assault, the artillery battery, had been removed. The Rangers then regrouped and small patrols were sent off in search for the guns. These patrols discovered 5 of the 6 guns nearby and destroyed the firing mechanisms with thermite grenades, with a lost casualty list of 135 killed and wounded. The primary objective at Utah Beach was to secure an 8-kilometer deep beachhead and to link up with the British forces landing at Gold Beach to the east, as well as reaching the area of Easling to the west to link up with the 11th Corps landing at Utah Beach. Utah Beach had been divided into 10 sectors: Charlie, Dog Green, Dog White, Dog Red, Easy Green, Easy White, Easy Red, Fox Green, Fox White, and Fox Red. The untested American 29th Infantry Division, along with 9 companies of U.S. Army Rangers redirected from Pointe du Hoc, assaulted the western half of the beach. The battle-hardened 1st Infantry Division was given the eastern half. The initial assault waves, consisting of tanks, infantry, and combat engineer forces, were carefully planned to reduce coastal defenses and to allow for larger ships during the follow-up waves. Very little went as planned during the landing at Omaha. Difficulties in navigation caused the majority of the landing crafts to miss their targets. The German defenses were unexpectedly strong and inflicted heavy casualties on the landing U.S. troops. Under heavy fire, the engineers struggled to clear the beach obstacles and caused later landing waves to bunch up around the few channels that had been cleared. Weakened by casualties taken during the landings, the surviving assault troops could not clear the heavily defended exits off the beach. This caused further problems and consequent delays for the later landings. Small penetrations were eventually achieved by groups of survivors, making improvised assaults and scaling the bluffs between the most heavily defended points. By the end of the day, 2 small isolated footholds had been won, which were subsequently exploited against weaker defenses further inland, thus achieving the original objectives over the following days, with a casualty and loss list estimated between 2,000 and 4,700.
Since that time, we have been able to bring in quite a bit of equipment. There are various trucks and jeeps and motor vehicles of all kinds here. There are also anti-aircraft guns. We've breached the seawall in various places and have set up guns there to defend against any possible enemy counterattack on the beaches, which has not occurred. A naval party has just come in from the shore, and I asked him how things were going, and he said it was pretty rough still. I asked him how far the troops had gone on inshore, and he said that they'd got 5 or 6 miles inshore, which sounds as though they're making good progress. He said that the beach was still under considerable gunfire. The Germans had some 88s, which we hadn't been able to silence. These boys are apparently having a pretty tough time in here on the beaches.
As the morning of June 6, 1944 migrated into afternoon and then into the evening, the young men who landed on the beaches of Normandy continued to fight and perish on the beaches of Gold, Sword, and Juno. On June 8, 1944, after years of planning, preparation, and placating egos among his military peers, Eisenhower was able to report that the Allies had made a harrowing and deadly, but ultimately successful landing on the beaches of Normandy. Thanks to the collective effort and military might of the Western Allies and the young men who fought and died on the beaches of Normandy, France, at a cost of 226,386 casualties, a loss of 4,101 aircraft, and 4,000 tanks. Hey everybody, and welcome to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II based podcast. And if the microphone sounds a little different or my voice sounds a little different from what you heard at the beginning of the show, that's because that is something that I recorded last year for the celebration of the 74th anniversary of D-Day landings in Normandy, France. And it's kind of cool to think about it that this little show has been going on long enough that I can now reuse things that I did a while back. But some of you are probably thinking that's pretty damn lazy, Don. Well, I agree with you. That is lazy. And I am wore out. Got home from work today, passed out. It is now 11:18 p.m. and I'm doing this podcast because I want to get it out before tomorrow. As some of you know, Memorial Weekend, I was invited out to the National Museum of the Pacific War by Jeff Copsetta, the Living History Director. And so I took that trip, and it was a great trip, and I'll get to more of that in a minute. But then I came back that Sunday, had to get to the airport at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Flight took off, landed in Atlanta, had a 3-hour layover in Atlanta, then a flight home. All said and done, I spent probably 10 hours at the airport that day. Now, being 6'5" in a small Delta flight is not good on the back. The longer of the two flights, I was on this older style Delta with the smaller seats that don't recline very well. And when I went out to the museum, I was concerned. You know, we put all this effort, this planning, and cost into this trip out there to record these interviews and to experience all that the National Museum of the Pacific War has to offer, especially to us living historians. And so because of the amount of effort and planning that went into this trip, I took 2 laptops with me. Now, flying on a budget, I knew that I could only have 2 carry-ons, and so I had the ingenious idea of stacking 2 laptops in 1 laptop bag. It worked. It counted as 1 carry-on, but I'll tell you this, it's heavy, and when you're walking around the Atlanta airport for 3 hours, it gets heavier. And then you add your backpack on with that, it gets heavier, and then you add the fact that you're 6'5", sitting in a small chair, you've been traveling for 12 hours, carrying around 2 laptops and 1 bag on your shoulder, plus a book bag, your back will slowly, methodically give out on you, and it's painful. And so I get back from Texas, Memorial Day, I'm walking around and back hurts even more, and it gets to the point where I can't walk. And by the way, if you're in the Texas area and you're a reenactor, hell, you don't even have to be a full-blown reenactor. If you have an interest in history and you have an interest in reenacting and you want to get hooked up in their volunteer program, that's easier said than done, believe it or not. Actually, it's easier done than said. Jeff is constantly looking for new volunteers to join the ranks, if you will, at the National Museum. And so I will put up an address where you can email him if you're in the area and you're interested in getting put on the roster. So I got back to Florida on Monday, Memorial Day. Obviously took it easy. Back was killing me. Killing me to the point that I had to go to a chiropractor. Did the whole laying down for a half hour, got the electrodes on the back and the massage and all that stuff, and then he adjusted me and broke my neck. And I was feeling good. I was up walking around for about a half hour, but then I had to take a long car ride because I had to go to work out in Lehigh, Florida, which is about 45 minutes where I'm at. So the weird thing about my back ailment is it only gets worse when I sit down, so or lay down for that matter. So when I wake up in the morning, I'm stiff as hell. It hurts to move. But as I force myself to move, as the day progresses, I'm feeling pretty good by the time I get home, as long as I'm not driving around too much. And that's where this is leading. So I got back Monday, couldn't walk, went to the chiropractor, forced myself to go to work Tuesday. And then Wednesday at 7 a.m. promptly, I hopped in the car and I drove 17 long, tedious hours from Fort Myers, Florida, up to Warsaw, Kentucky, because my nephew, who lives in northern Kentucky, up in a big Florence, mind you, was graduating high school, and it's a big deal. So my father drove up on his own day, then I drove up. My mom lives up there, my stepsister, my biological sister, my cousins, all that. But I'll tell you what, driving 17 hours with extreme lower back pain is crushing. But it gets worse because 4 days later, Monday, so I got up there Wednesday, got there 1 a.m. Thursday, slept Friday, did some stuff, Saturday, Sunday, left Sunday and Monday, and what a horrible long drive home it was. But now here we are, it's Wednesday, it's almost Thursday at this point. My back hasn't gotten any better. So here we are, worn out and beat up, but hey, we're bringing the show to you. I'm rambling on. But thanks to Jeff, thanks to the fine people at the National Museum of the Pacific War for inviting me out, allowing me to participate in a program with your guys. On the next few episodes of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, there will be some interviews, some topics sprinkled in amongst the other content about the National Museum, because I have gotten so many interviews and I got so much content. I didn't want to just put it in one big bulk episode and blow it out in 2 days. So we're gonna salt and pepper it in throughout the next episodes. It is the 75th anniversary of D-Day. We're not going to get too much into it other than what we did at the opening of the show, because it's everywhere. I mean, we're all reenactors. We're all historians. If you're listening to this podcast, it is because you have something special with World War II. And if you're like me, you follow a lot of Instagram pages, a lot of Facebook pages, a lot of Twitter pages that revolve around World War II. And so your timeline is probably inundated with the topic, and that's great. And so I figured it really wasn't much that I could get into on that subject that isn't being covered by other people better than what I can do with my shoestring budget. So it is the 75th anniversary of D-Day in Normandy, France. There are a few of the people I follow on Facebook who were over there. I reached out to one. I was trying to get an interview set up with him, but unfortunately he's super busy, and I was trying to get a hold of him through Facebook Instant Messenger, and he doesn't have very good Wi-Fi out there, and so he probably won't see my contact with him until he gets back to his hotel later. Probably, I don't know what the time zone is over there. It's greatly different. But anyhow, back to the National Museum of the Pacific War. I flew out there. Like I said, I got there Friday. Got there before most of the volunteers, because the program really didn't start until Saturday. So I kind of got the Friday behind the scenes. Was lucky enough to get a full-blown tour of everything that has to do with what the National Museum of the Pacific War refers to as the Pacific Combat Zone. Because the Pacific Combat Zone actually sits down the street from the main museum, because the museum is now kind of broken up into multiple divisions. You have the original location where the whole thing started, which was the Nimitz House. It's a hotel, the Nimitz Hotel. And then throughout the years, the collection expanded, and then they started to build the actual museum up the street. And then down the street is where the soundstage, I like to call it, the Pacific Combat Zone is located. And the reason I call it a soundstage is because that is pretty much what it is. The Pacific Combat Zone is to reenacting what a skate park is to a skateboarder. It's an area that is built specifically for the purpose and that it is being used for. We reenactors were so used to showing up at an air show, out behind a museum, maybe even to a gun show, a military swap meet. And there's like, you know, a football field worth of grass partitioned off with some caution tape, which is very error correct. A couple of bales of hay out there. Maybe an overturned wagon that was used by the farmer down the street. Some bales of hay, a couple of barrels, and voila. You got yourself a battlefield in the European Theater of Operations. And that's the way most reenactings go. And to be honest with you, I've talked to a lot of living historians, or a handful of them, who don't participate in reenactments because of that. They think going out into an empty cornfield or an empty field in the corner of a parking lot just looks silly. It doesn't really, it really doesn't bring anything as far as remembering those who died, and they just find the whole thing kind of silly. And so they don't participate in the actual reenactments. They only do the living history side. And I get it. I kind of see that, but you know, I still participate. But having a place, a lot, a soundstage, a skate park, if you will, something that is designed to look as much as a Pacific battlefield as you possibly can. I mean, they got palm trees and blown out anti-aircraft gun. They got bunkers, trenches, shell casings, empty barrels all shot up laying around. There are very cool pyrotechnics. When the mortar sounds come in through the sound stage, you got dirt blowing up. When the landing craft comes in, you got water pots going off. I shot a video. Their standard operating procedure for the Living History program, because they want it to come off so well, if you never participated, they do two shows on Saturday and two shows on Sunday. So they ask you to sit and be a spectator for the first show, so you can see what it looks like, see what's happening, see what's the battle plan is. And to be honest with you, I'm glad they did, because the interesting thing about reenacting, as we all know, is when you're out there doing it, you only see 4 feet in front of you. You know, you're focusing on what your job is, what your role in the play is, if you will, and so you don't see what's going on around you. I've done many reenactments with tanks, where there's 3 or 4 of them, and I may not even see them the whole time I'm out there. I hear them, I feel them, but I'm not paying attention to them. I'm paying attention to my task. And so it was very cool to actually sit and watch, and in my case, film. I did film it. It will be in the video I'm putting out later. But it was very cool to film the thing, because I actually got to see the show for what it was. I got to see what the spectator sees. I got to survey the land, if you will. I got to see the Army coming in off their landing craft, the Marines coming in, the Japanese running. And so I was very thrilled. Once it was all said and done, I was very happy that I had the opportunity to sit and watch and to enjoy the whole show. I strongly suggest you guys go onto YouTube. Simply type in the National Museum of the Pacific War, World War II reenactment, and videos will come up. And if you've been to the museum, but it's been 4, 5, 6, 8, 10, 12, 15 years, I strongly recommend you go back, because the new Pacific Battle Zone has only been up, let's call it version 2.0, maybe even version 3 at this point, but it's only been put together for about 2 or 3 years now, and so you've got to go back and see it. It's a great show. Jeff and the boys do a great job there. And one of the guys who makes things work is a fellow named Aaron. Now, Aaron's a jack of many trades. He basically manages the motor pool. He basically is in charge of firing up the pyrotechnics during the show, making the show go. He is the guy up in the top of the bunker, pushing the buttons, letting off the pots. He's the guy behind the scenes. There's a few other guys, but he's one of the guys. And so we sit down with Aaron. He'll be our first interview from the... He's not a volunteer. He works there full-time. So Aaron is a full-time employee at the National Museum of the Pacific War, particularly in the Pacific Battle Zone area. And so we're going to start this episode off with an interview with Aaron. And I hope you guys enjoy it. And, 75th anniversary of D-Day. Let's enjoy that. Take that in and focus on that. But, we're going to veer away from that a little bit. I know I'm rambling on. It's late. I'm tired. But I wanted to get the show out there. And before we sit down with Aaron, I just want to remind everybody, let's get the housekeeping out of the way. If you want to support the show, please, 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 I cannot beg anymore. Please go to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on the Become a Patron link and subscribe to Patreon. There's a $1 a month plan, there's a $3.50 a month plan, and there's a $7.50 a month. If you join the $7.50, I'll send you a t-shirt. So that's out of the way. WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on the red button on the right, it says Become a Patron. I would greatly appreciate you signing up for that. If that's not your bag, you don't want to, and you're an Amazon shopper, while you're on that website, just go ahead and click on the Amazon link. Save that on your favorites bar or create a shortcut to your desktop, however you want to do it. And then in the future, when you do your Amazon shopping, please use that link, and it won't cost you anything extra, but Amazon will kick me some coinage. We have t-shirts, like always. I got a new WTSP shirt up there. You see everybody walking around with these cross logos with the X with some initials, so I made one out of the 18-inch bayonets using our logo. Had a listener from my other podcast, the Waterman D-Train Show. No, I take that back. He's a listener of this podcast as well. He wanted a Suck It Up Buttercup t-shirt. So that is now available in multiple colors, including OD Green. Mine should be here in a day or two. The new Suck It Up Buttercup t-shirt is available at WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on the t-shirt link. Now, if you're going to the website on a tablet or on your phone and you're not seeing this stuff, WordPress is weird. On a computer, it'll be on the right-hand side. But on the mobile devices, you have to scroll all the way to the bottom. All the way. Keep going. Keep going. Yep, there, right there. Stop. There's a t-shirt. Click on that. That'll take you to our web store. And you can find all t-shirts. I think there's like 16 t-shirts up there now. If you don't want a t-shirt, you don't shop on Amazon. And you don't care to sign up for Patreon. But you are into working out and the athletic lifestyle. Go to sleefs.com, S-L-E-E-F-S.com. Anything you buy, use the promo code D41040. That'll save you 40% on your order, and they will kick me some coins that way, too. And finally, this episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast is brought to you by our friends at ACK Computers. ACK Computers has been servicing all of Southwest Florida's computer needs since 2004. They do specialize in veterinarian and medical clinics. They do other small businesses, anything with a server, sonic walls, security, multiple computers. If you need to secure your web-based applications using two-form factor authentication, they can help you out there. If you need to back up your computers online, they can help you with some online backup. They can help you with antivirus programs. If you're not in Southwest Florida, they can still help. Just give them a call, 239-283-1120. They will direct you to their website, and they can log in remotely and fix all of your issues that way. act-capecoral.com or 239-283-1120. And one of the people currently in Normandy, France right now is a gentleman named Al. And I was lucky enough to meet Al out in Fredericksburg. He is one of the volunteers at the National Museum for the Pacific War. And Al runs a beautiful bed and breakfast. It's called the Bella Vista Ranch, located in Fredericksburg. And the day I got there, Friday, Jeff said, hey, one of our living historians has a bed and breakfast about 15, 20 minutes from here. His name's Al. He's got like 5 bedrooms. There's multiple bathrooms, multiple showers. And he's willing to put up some of the guys for the weekend. And I thought I'd offer it up to you first. And I said, absolutely. And luckily, I rented a small SUV, rented a Toyota RAV4. Because if I would have rented a car in Texas, especially in Fredericksburg, Texas, out in the highlands, if you will, I may have bottomed out trying to get up Al's driveway because it's a beautiful piece of property nestled up on a hillside in between two cattle ranches. And so the driveway is much like we had in Kentucky growing up. All gravel, a little bit of rises and falls. And so luckily I had the little SUV with me. Made it up there in the middle of the night. And actually, that's a lie. I went there in the afternoon, got my key, met Al's beautiful wife. She showed me where everything was, gave me a key. The overlook from this property, you guys can see the video at the What's the Scuttlebutt Facebook page. I'll try to put it on YouTube so you can see it as well. But the view from this property is amazing. So if you're going to go to Fredericksburg and you're planning on staying there a weekend or so and you want to get a beautiful, beautiful place to stay, I strongly suggest hitting up Al and his wife at the Bella Vista Ranch in Fredericksburg, Texas. Their phone number is 1-866-427-8374. Trust me, you will not be sorry, especially if there's a group of you. House is beautiful. You can't beat the view. If this house was in California, that view would be a multi-million dollar view. I cannot express to you the beauty of the view and how nice it is, especially if you're lucky enough to get the volunteer for the weekend and you're going to participate in the living history. After ducking, diving, jumping, crawling, rolling all day, coming home to a hot shower and a queen-size bed beats the hell out of a tent any day. So give Bella Vista Ranch a call, Fredericksburg, Texas, 866-427-8374. Follow them on Facebook. Al's a great guy. He's actually going to join us, hopefully, for the 75th anniversary of Peleliu in Fort Morgan, Alabama. So you guys will get to meet him there. I'm going to try to reach out to him, see if I can get an interview. It'll be a few days late and a dollar short, but hey, that's the way timing works with podcasts. But he's in Normandy, France now. I want to talk to him about his experience. But anyhow, on with the show. Joining us right now, we are... This is actually, probably will be out of order, but this is technically the first interview we are doing here at the, I guess, the facility for the living history side of the National Museum for the Pacific War. And joining us right now is the guy who works side by side with Jeff Copsetta. He's actually the guy who gets it done. You know, Jeff comes up with the ideas, takes the credit. But this gentleman is the one that actually sees things get done, and he actually gets it done. Mr. Aaron Vallander?
Varender. Yeah.
Aaron Varender.
Yes.
Mr. Aaron Varender. Aaron, what is your official title here at the National Museum for the Pacific War? Technically, we are in the Pacific War Combat Zone, correct?
Yes, sir, we are. It's the Living History Department of the Education Department. So we bring history to life, and my job title is basically Lead Mechanic / Education Associate. But I do way more than that.
I was going to say, you basically help build and maintain the battlefield.
Yes.
You're basically the proxy, basically put in charge of the placement of pyrotechnics.
Yes.
You are the pyrotechnic engineer who detonates all said pyrotechnics during the show.
Yes.
Now, I know there's a gentleman here whose role is to be in charge of the weapons and the battery, but you kind of take that on yourself as well.
Yeah, I do that. That's my main secondary role is armorer, and I take care of all the weapons as we go.
Now, you guys have a pretty impressive motor pool. You have, like, what, 13 vehicles?
13 vehicles in dire need of service and repair.
That keeps you busy for the most part when Jeff's not, you know, making faces at you through the window when you're trying to help promote his show here. And yes, but, you know, that's what Jeff does.
Yep.
Give us a little background on you.
Well, I have a very unique family. It's pretty large worldwide. In my immediate family, I'm the first American. I was born in Massachusetts. My mom's Canadian. My dad's English. But my affiliation with World War II is my grandfather was an RAF bomber pilot. He was a Lancaster bomber driver.
Mm-hmm.
He was KIA October 22nd, 1943, and bombing Cassel. He was bombing Tiger I tank factories with incendiary bombs.
Wow.
So he was hit with a Bf 110 Messerschmitt night fighter. He saved his whole crew, but his tail gunner and himself. He went down on his third mission in his brand new Lancaster. And the irony of it all is he delivered mail to the Mediterranean for quite some time before he got transferred to the bomber groups.
So he was pretty familiar with the area.
Yes.
And the area which he serviced as a postal, not really a postal carrier, but a postal transporter.
Yeah, for the RAF.
Is the same areas that he's now laying waste to.
Yeah. So, yeah, he did a good job. He died at 21, and then my grandmother remarried Mr. Varender, which he was a sub hunter in the English Channel, flew Catalinas, which was kind of the PBR or float planes.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to ask him as a kid, I said, so, how many submarines did you sink? And he always just said, oh, two whales. We only got two whales. That's all he would tell me when he had three cigarettes in his mouth and a big old thing of scotch.
Sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, World War II was a big thing in our family, and it did blow things up. But outside of that, I was born in Massachusetts and grew up in Texas. I was raised here in Texas. And I used to work in wildlife before I entered the museum world. And it's pretty unique. I started a year ago, and it's been a wild ride since I started.
Now, you have military service underneath your belt,
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I have 6 years in the Marine Corps. I did Desert Shield Storm as a logistical proponent. It's called the Traffic Management Office of the 2nd Marine Division. And that's where I learned my logistical capabilities. Turned out that Desert Storm was the largest and fastest moving American equipment in history.
Really?
Yeah.
Even larger and faster than what we did during the big one?
Yes, it was. We moved it quicker than any amount of equipment that we've ever done in the world, in World War II, since Desert Storm. So a lot of people don't know that, but I was part of that system, and we worked hard from Shield to Storm, nonstop, no sleep. So that's when I found out war was bigger than what you see on TV.
Yeah, because when people hear about war, think about war, see movies about the wars, it's all about the front line. It's all about the guys flying the planes, dropping the bombs, having the dogfights. But in order for those guys to get to where they're going, there's a huge, huge organization of men and women.
Yes.
Logistics, transportation, planning, everything. I mean, as we all famously know, Patton used to get frustrated when he would outrun his supply line during World War II. Well, that hasn't changed. Just because technology has gotten better and vehicles got a little bit of better gas mileage, there's still a whole huge amount of, obviously, fuel, parts, service. I mean,
it's insane.
For every, I don't know, I'm sure there's a actual numerical statistic, but I don't know it. I'm just going to make shit up in my head. For every one guy in the field, there's probably, what, 20, 30 behind him?
Yep, that's including family members. Yeah. Family members are the largest support group of anybody in the field. Without that mail, because the Germans figured out if they stop the mail,
kill morale.
Yeah, and you slow down those troops because they get disconnected. And we figured that out too. So we started bombing Tokyo. What happened to the troops finding out that their home was getting torched by firebombs?
Sure.
They were just devastated because they're the warriors and they're the people they were trying to protect. We just flew over them. So that was pretty devastating on their end.
Well, and it kind of makes sense now. I never really thought about it, but here we are talking about fuel, Patton running out of fuel, the need for planes and logistics. But the United States military dedicated a lot of logistics to V-mail.
Yep.
A lot of time, a lot of fuel, a lot of money promoting, getting the words out about V-mail that could hypothetically have been redirected elsewhere, but they knew that line of communication, being the only form of a line of communication they had back then, was so important that you have to keep your men as happy as possible in its horrible situations. I mean, it's amazing what a simple letter home can do for someone after going through weeks or months of horrible, horrible things just to have that boost.
Yeah.
And unfortunately for the guys who served in the Pacific, their letters would rot away so quick due to the weather. But in Europe and other theaters where it was drier, more conducive to paper, those guys would read those same letters over. And that hasn't changed either.
No, when I got mail, the perfume.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, man. I would sit there and sniff. Without even opening the letter, I'd sniff the letter for about a minute. Just getting the aroma of home. I mean, it was awesome.
Yeah, there's a famous story, and forgive me, I can't remember. I think it was in Robert Leckie's With the Old Breed. Mm-hmm. It may have even been in Sledge's, but no, I believe it was Robert Leckie's. He was talking about one night there was a fight going on. There's a ruckus, and they couldn't figure out what was coming from. And it turns out it was two foxhole buddies, and they were fighting over the range card.
Wow.
For the mortars. Yeah. Well, range card mortar, it had to have been E.B. Sledge because he was in the mortar.
Right.
They're fighting over the range card for the mortars because the girls had good intentions at the factory. They actually would kiss the range cards and then spray their perfume on them.
Yep.
And these guys have been living in foxholes for months on end.
Yeah.
They would find it and they would end up getting in fisticuffs because that, just the smell, the amount of vision in one's head in a lonely night in a foxhole in a horrible situation where you're looking for anything to try to minimize the smell that's stuck in your nostril.
Right.
The horrible things you're seeing in your head. You're looking for anything. And that smell and that card and just rubbing your finger over that lipstick, that's like, you know, better than anything that we have on the internet nowadays. And so those girls thought they're, you know, and they did do good, but they would inadvertently cause fisticuffs because those guys wanted that motivation.
The first war movie that I saw I thought was a masterpiece was Forrest Gump.
Mm-hmm.
When he was writing those letters to Jenny. And then he gets shot in the butt, and he ends up in the hospital, and they dump all those letters in his lap. I was like, wow. I was like, man, that's crazy. You got returned to center. Because when I deployed a lot, well, especially at Storm, once the mail followed us all around the world, and then end up going return to center. So if I sent mails out, it never got out.
Yeah.
It came back to me,
to
my base. So then I had to resend everything.
Wow.
So you'd get a big old box like of mail letters that you sent out to family, friends, and stuff like that. And you're like, what? So you have to remail everything. What I did was I just put it in a Ziploc bag, put it in another envelope, and mailed it again.
Yeah.
But once we got back to base, my mail got back out.
No spoiler alert, Platoon's 30 years old now. But in Platoon,
yeah,
Charlie Sheen's writing to Grandma, or at least when he's doing the narration, he's talking to Grandma. And I think somewhere around the end of the movie, there was no Grandma. That was just his way of processing his feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And but I guess we need to get back a little bit on the subject at hand.
Logistics, that's part of it.
Now, you and Jeff put on between 7 to 8 shows a year.
Yes.
And I don't know if this phrase that I've been spitting out all weekend is approved or appreciated, but I keep saying you guys are the Universal Studio of Living History, because I've done a lot of Living History events over the last 8 years. I've done Fort Morgan in Alabama. I've done Georgia events. I've done hundreds of Florida events. I've done events with tanks. But that's usually about it. Pyrotechnics are usually nil. You know, I've done one landing craft, but you guys literally have a landing craft on tracks that comes out of a building. The ramp drops. You got fire, not fire, but water bombs going off to demonstrate or to simulate mortar rounds hitting around the boats. You got full stereo effect underneath your canopy of your amphitheater.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do you have the visual, because a lot of reenactments, yeah, we can make compressed air pots to throw dirt, but you don't have the sound effect to go along with it.
Right.
Now, obviously, you got 30 guys out there shooting. It kind of gets lost in a mix, and so you can hide it that way. But because of what they have been able to achieve here with the static layout of having a battlefield that is designed for this exact use, I mean, this is essentially a skate park for reenactors. I mean,
Right. Yeah,
when you go out skating, you could set up a ramp or, you know, wax on a curb, but it's not the same as a skate park. And so you guys actually have something that you can continue to grow upon instead of building it up for a week and tearing it down,
right,
building it up. And so you can continue to grow and change things around. Now, I know Jeff said it usually takes you and him about 10 days to reset after each show because of the laundry and the weapons. He said you got to clean 63 weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And just give us a little bit of how do you guys, I'm sure at this point you have a pretty well-oiled machine, but you just came on, what, 2018, 2017?
March of 2018.
And Jeff said you are a godsend. He said before you came on, he was trying to manage all this.
Mm-hmm.
And not only do you help him with all that, but you kind of act as a proxy for all the volunteers who can't get a hold of him.
Oh, yeah.
And so you've been able to pick up the slack there. And he can't speak highly enough about you. He's just so thrilled to have you on his staff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the weapons side, when I started, we had quite a bit of weapons that were disarray. So we went through each weapon and we ordered parts for them and we got them going. But our biggest failure is those M1 carbines. They're the toughest things to blank adapt. And
because you got to thread the barrels.
Yeah, we thread the barrels, but you got to get the hole right, the pressure right in the barrel, and the carbines, the blanks have to be, you know, hot to do what they have to do, and it wears those guns down fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it just shows that these weapons of war that they made, where their longevity is not very long.
Well, they were never intended to be used 7 years later. Their goal was hopefully 2-5 years at the most.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to come up with some money to replace the carbines because we're getting less and less on the battlefield. But I noticed a lot of the volunteers are buying their own.
Yeah.
Which is big help.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's huge.
Well, Jeff and I were talking about that on the last episode he was on. One of the nice benefits that you guys are able to do, and the group I was a part of on a smaller scale, not to rehash old episodes, but I worked with a guy named John Thomas, and he put together the 1st Infantry Division. And because his son started when he was 14, he knew that a lot of places, you know, can't start until you're 16, 18, plus all this stuff's expensive. And so that's a huge barrier to entry for young cats. That's why most reenactors are 40, 50, because they got good jobs and careers, they can afford it. Mm-hmm. And so he would volunteer for museums, he'd do fundraisers, and he would raise money, and he would buy some uniforms, buy some boots, and buy a couple of rifles. And on a smaller scale, he had a utility trailer. And he would try to find 16, 17, 18-year-old kids who were interested, but whose parents weren't quite sure they wanted to invest the finances in it, because kids have a tendency to change their interests quickly.
Right.
And so what he would do is, hey, come out, I'll outfit you, and if you enjoy it, slowly. And so these kids would start, and someone would fall out, someone would get bored, and someone would fall in love with it, and then they'd go out and buy their own trousers and their own shirt. Okay, well, now I only got to give you boots and web gear. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Christmas rolls around, their parents give them boots and web gear, and so now he's just loaning them rifles, and before you know it, within a year and a half, boom, you got a rifle. And so he was able to kind of do what you guys do, and it's so cool to see, and you guys see it here too. You have people who come who started out as just volunteers because it's something fun and cool to do on a weekend, right. And then they get the history bug, and then they're spending their own money or their Christmases, and their, mm-hmm. and by them getting their own stuff, it takes a little bit of the burden off you, but also allows you to bring other people in to extend your volunteer corps.
Right, and what's pretty unique is when I started, there was only a few Japanese on the Japanese side, just.
Yeah.
Four people at times.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, you know, the Japanese are dug in, so they just need a couple of heads.
That's always the excuse. I've done a few tactical events and a few PTO, and it's all, well, they're dug in. And yes, that's the truth. I'd rather have four of them than none.
Right.
Because we need, and you know, you always got to have a bad guy to shoot at. And that, and the, let's be honest, it's easier to do a European theater war. Go ahead, I'll just edit that up.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, it's easier to do European theater war because most of these guys, they'll do Ally 1 week and German the next week, and they'll just throw some bad German out there and they'll pass.
Right.
But a lot of people, one, they don't feel comfortable sometimes, not all the time, but a lot of people don't feel comfortable portraying a whole other race.
Right.
And two, you know, especially if you're like me, 6'5", you're not going to pass off as a Japanese soldier too well.
Maybe one or two.
Yeah.
Yeah, they actually had big ones every now and then.
And so it's definitely nice to be an event where you have more than three guys running from different positions popping up like whack-a-mole, trying to put on the appearance that there's more of them than there actually are.
Well, since I expanded the battlefield and the bunkers, our Japanese Corps has gotten bigger.
And one of the other things you guys did, I don't know if you did intentionally or if just the way the numbers served out, is you actually have quite a few females play those roles. And so they have the smaller body type and stuff in the distance. Uniforms. Yeah, they fit the role a little better.
Mm-hmm. And they're